محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Doing a song from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Taqwi. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has urged Muslim and Arab states to help protect Al-Aqsa Mosque in the face of incessant Israeli desecration. The Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islam's third holiest site. Hamas says it hopes the Islamic world would take responsibility and protect the mosque. In this edition of The Spotlight, we look at why this has not happened in the way that it should and why repeated incursions of Israeli settlers into Al-Aqsa continues under the protection of Israeli regime forces. First, let me introduce our guest. Rabbi David Weiss, spokesman at Neturei Karta International, joins us from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Paul Larudi, co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement, who joins us from Berkeley, California. Welcome to you both. Paul Larudi, I'll start with you, and just for the sake of general knowledge, give us a historical perspective, briefly, of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, why it is obviously one of the most, aside from the fact that it's one of the most contentious issues between Israelis and Palestinians, but the religious significance that it has when it comes to Muslims and Jews.
Well, it's considered, as every Muslim knows, it's considered the third holiest site in Islam after Mecca and Medina. And it's the place where at least Jerusalem is at least the place where Muhammad is considered to have ascended to heaven, the Prophet Muhammad. And this is an immensely important place for sacred place for a lot of Muslims. Also, of course, it's the capital of Palestine and the historic capital of Palestine. And therefore, immensely important to Palestinians. It's their most treasured place in within Palestine. So there has been a threat to Al-Aqsa since the time that Israel captured Jerusalem. Invaded and captured Jerusalem. So it's and since then they've been encroaching more and more, not of course only in Jerusalem, but in much of the rest of Palestine. So this is part of the problem. The Israeli policy is to work towards a state which is entirely Jewish. No remnant of anything non-Jewish in the state, not the Palestinian people, not the Muslim people, not the Christian people, nothing. This is their ultimate goal. And little by little, by encroachment, they're working towards it.
All right. When you mention the word encroachment Rabbi Weiss, tell us in what ways is Israel doing that when it comes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque? I mean, one of the common occurrences are these Israeli settlers that go and desecrate the mosque, in a matter of speaking, under the watchful eye and protection of the Israeli regime forces. This is a common occurrence, as unfortunate as that is. Why do you think they continue to do that? Some say it's to change the makeup from an Islamic nature to one of their liking.
Yes, well, with the help of the Almighty,
we have to always put first in our thought process to remember that the whole state of Israel is a charade. They're masquerading, unfortunately, tragically, in our religion of Judaism. They use the Star of David. They use the name Israel, which is Jacob in the Torah. They try to use all the trappings of holiness. I mean, it's a farce that they need to, that they want even the temple and that area, because these people flagrantly desecrate all the laws of the Torah. In fact, when Sharon and today the Ben-Gavir, whatever, they went up on the Temple Mount, it happens to be that Jewish people are forbidden. It's like haram. It's considered one of the greatest rebellions against God for a Jew to go up on that area, because we don't have the purity of that which required to go in that area. Even if it would be just, you know, a totally desolate place, we would never, if we have for 2,000 years, we are forbidden to go on that area because of its holiness. And when they're going there, it's only to, like you were saying, to make a statement that this is their land because God gave them, abusing and misinterpreting the words of the Holy Torah. I carry around with me one of our booklets. It's called Al-Aqsa, the true religious Jewish position Al-Aqsa, where we have the statements of Rabbi Zonnenfeld, Yosef Chaim Zonnenfeld, of blessed memory, who lived from 1848 to 1932. And he put into the Muslim papers, he put a statement where he said that the Jews do not in any way want to take what isn't theirs. They certainly don't want to contest the right of the other inhabitants to the places held by them, which they regard with honor and considered holy. In particular, there's no foundation to the rumor that the Jews want to acquire the Temple Mount.
Okay.
Now, this is, he goes on with his statement. This is Rabbi Zonnenfeld of blessed memory, who was the chief rabbi of Palestine, and he was the one who met with the king of Transjordan in the 1920s,
okay,
and clearly representing the Jewish community of
right,
of before the state of Israel. Now, the ones these Israelis say they have a rabbi.
If you can hold on to your thoughts, let me continue with Paul Rerudi, get him a little bit into the conversation, and I'll come right back to you, Rabbi Weiss. You know, Paul Rerudi, we know that this is not a new thing, this changing of the not only the demographics, but the Islamic nature of the Al-Aqsa Mosque is something that has been going on for quite some time. But under this extreme cabinet, it seems like it's a whole new ball game. The person that comes to mind is his extreme minister, Itamar Ben-Gavir. I mean, he likes to go out there, and he wants to promote this. He came from a settler community, so he's going to promote that mentality. Tell us in what ways he is different than before, which I can only say that he's more outspoken and he's working at an accelerated pace, if you agree.
And this is what Zionist leadership, the worldwide Zionist, but especially leadership of the so-called State of Israel, has decided is the future. They have decided that the best way to have what they call a Jewish state is to bring the most radical elements, the most war, genocide, racist elements in the population that they planted there, to drive out every trace of anything besides what is defined in their ideology of Zionism. And they have decided that actually they might even go against many other Jews, not only those like Rabbi Weiss and the Neturei Karta, but also many of the Jews who don't have the fanatical attachment that they have and the fanatical goals of genocide. They don't mind alienating a lot of American Jews who really don't care about that very much, because they see their future as the radical elements taking over And this is part of that. This is why it's moving in an ever more radical, violent, genocidal direction. It's a part of the plan. It's a part of the plan to convert the region into a what they call a Jewish state. And exclusively Jewish state.
Indeed. Well, we can't forget, Rabbi Weiss, how they, not this administration, but the one prior, ran the nation state law, which actually just appropriates the land for Jews and doesn't even recognize the inhabitants, the real inhabitants, which are the Palestinians. But I'd like to get your understanding of this Itamar Ben-Gvir, or the likes of him, but in particular this extreme minister, and also others like Smotrich. What do you think of them and the way that they're carrying through and enacting what they want to enact? What kind of representation is that?
Well, with the help of the Almighty, you know, we look at the whole establishment of the State of Israel. Obviously, as I said, and clearly, according to Judaism, we are forbidden to have a state, even, regardless if it would even have been an uninhabited land. Jews are forbidden to have such a sovereignty since 2,000 years ago, since the destruction of the Temple. At that time, it was a holy concept, nothing to do with this farce of a Zionist State of Israel, which is just a political state. Then it was a concept of serving God, being subservient to God. But since then, since 2,000 years ago, we're even forbidden to have that. But these Zionists who are totally rebels against God, what they're doing, and they're creating their state. So it's just the whole concept is one non-halal. It's just not kosher. It's not the halal. It's a total rebellion against God. It's nuanced when it was Rabin. Or if it's, you know, there's always different levels of people on and their approach of how they're going to acquire or to fulfill their fantasy of having, you know, their sovereignty. So you had some that are less extreme, and then there are some who are trying to incorporate more Jewish concepts into it. But all of it is repugnant, repulsive, and hurts us terribly as Jews around the world. We cry and we suffer and we hurt with what they're doing to the Palestinians, whether it happens to be the settlers that are going in and yelling at the and attacking and murdering in Jenin or where it may be, or it was the subtle, not subtle really, but the nuanced, more subtle occupation that took in a quieter concept, but they simply took over the land and rejected the Palestinian people and oppressed them and so forth and so on. The end of the day is that whatever manner it's set up, state, it is not acceptable according to Jews, according to the Torah. What they're doing is a crime. It's against God. What people say, it's inhumane, it's against God. And we happen to be, sure. I'm right now sitting in Washington, mind you. I'm in Washington, D.C., because the president of the State of Israel was taken up in as a guest in our Congress here in the United States, and yesterday by our president. So we went out, a delegation of rabbis, and we demonstrated in front of the White House, and today we stood in this tremendous heat that we were almost fainting, and okay. We stood in front of Congress to tell the world, to tell these leaders that they're being conned, they're being duped. And it's nothing to do with anti-Semitism. What's happening here is an evil group, an evil concept that's occupying, and it's unacceptable, no matter sure. what shade of extreme it is.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's find out what you think about that, Paula Rudy. I mean, you know, you have the statements that have come out when it comes to the way that this Joe Biden administration has dealt with not only Netanyahu, but also the other extreme ministers, which has not been too pleasant, some of the words that have been expressed. But, you know, obviously the alignments is unwavering. They have said it time and again. But at the same time, they have shown some discontent. And that discontent is not just from the U.S. Also, European Union has even evaded meeting up with some of these ministers. How are these ministers changing the way that Israel is being viewed from the outside? Not that their favorability was increasing, but it was decreasing. But I think in another sense, this has also accelerated the pace of them being disliked on the world stage.
Well, there's a history of let's call it slapping the hand of Israel, because Israel sees the need for fanaticism, and they see that as their weapon to achieve their goal. So they the fanatics are not always going to follow instructions. And in fact, in the case of the relationship between Israel and the European states, and especially the United States, there's an argument to be made that Israel oftentimes is the master, and the United States is the servant in this. That is, they dictate some terms, not all of them. But they manipulate the United States. Now, the United States sees Israel as useful in mainly two ways. First of all, there is a powerful Zionist lobby in the United States, which is well-financed and which is very useful in terms of elections and in terms of getting things passed through Congress and various ways. It's a very strong internal lobby in Washington. So an alliance with the Zionists is important for any political career in the United States. There are very few exceptions. But the other thing is that the United States sees Israel as useful in their foreign policy in terms of dividing other parts of the world, in this case, mainly the Middle East, and as an agent for the United States in propping up fascist and imperialist regimes throughout Latin America and Asia and elsewhere. And so they think of Israel as useful. Personally, I think of the United States government as useless. And right. If we can get rid of it and get a proper government that responds to the needs of the American people, then we wouldn't have these problems, and neither would a lot of other nations around the world.
Well, Rabbi Weiss, since you mentioned the visit of the Israeli president, one of the things that has happened is that some of the U.S. lawmakers in protest actually skipped the speech that was made by Isaac Herzog. And also there was a poll that came out just a couple months back that showed that many U.S. lawmakers are actually siding more now with Palestinians than they are with Israel. And one of the core issues that they are having problems with is the way, overall, how Israelis are treating Palestinians. Do you think that the American population is realizing the extent that Palestinians are being oppressed by Israel?
You know, I have a white beard. We're standing up. It's 75 years since the existence of the state, and we have been from day one, as my predecessors and the great leaders and rabbis and holy men, and as we have been doing, and we continually do, we stand up and we do not get flustered. We will continue, with God's help, inshallah, to continue as long as we have we are breathing, to stand up and broadcast the truth. that it is unacceptable, the state, that is unacceptable in any shape or form, the occupation. And a lot of times through these periods, we saw times when Israel was weaker. And sometimes it seemed weaker. It seemed that it's going to be, it's going to finally disappear. And sometimes it seemed stronger. We know that is the Almighty who runs the world, and God is Almighty and compassionate, and that He will bring an end because this is evil. And the Torah says, "Why are you rebelling against me? It will not be successful. Okay. This state will end. We don't know when. We don't know how. But we do not look for hope at what conditions or certain circumstances." So, as I said, I'm not sure. It's very hard to really take the temperature of the people in the United States because there's so many different factions and different approaches. And the one thing is clear: they are still being duped, as a whole, that by the attack of anti-Semitic, that people think that opposing Israel is somehow opposing Judaism, when that is a total misnomer. It's totally wrong.
Sure.
On the contrary, supporting Israel creates exacerbates anti-Semitism. Supporting Israel creates a constant bloodshed of Palestinians and Jews alike. So I can't really say that. It is true that we have alternative media like internet and things that give the people the opportunity to see the truth of the oppression of the Palestinian people. And we hope sincerely that this will make people stand up for the Palestinians, and maybe it is really helping. But our hope is not in that, but only because we know we have a great God.
Okay, very well. I'm looking at the clock. I just got the last question to squeeze in here. Paul Arudi, this was a slap in the face. Roughly about a month ago, you have this Israeli lawmaker that suggested a plan to divide the Al-Aqsa Mosque, of which, looking at what he has said, 30% will be given to Muslims, which was, I guess, in the southern section of the complex, and the rest would be left for the Jews. I mean, this should have created a huge uproar, but it didn't gain the steam that it should, in a sense. But do you think that's something that Israel is going to act on?
I think that Israel will try to act on it and on the general, I think it'll act on trying to make Al-Aqsa itself disappear. I think that its ultimate aim is to remove anything that doesn't conform to their ideas of a Jewish state from the region. They just want to remove everything from Al-Quds and from the rest of the territory that they control. They just want nothing but what they consider good Jews. The Jews that criticize Israel and don't conform to what they want, well, they can leave too. I know Jews who are banned from Israel for that reason. They consider themselves Jews, but they have been banned. So they have this dream, and it's a racist dream, and it's a genocidal dream. And the way to make it happen is destruction of the holy sites to other religions in Jerusalem and elsewhere, and destruction of the people who are not the people that they want there.
Okay, thank you so much for that, Paul Arudi, co-founder of Free Palestine Movement from Berkeley. Rabbi Edweiss, thank you so much. A pleasure. Spokesman at Neture Karta International from Washington, D.C. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitale and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and chivalry. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service to your listeners. We are talking about chivalry and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So when we talk about chivalry, of course, the beautiful manifestation of chivalry can be seen in the land of Karbala. And so we find that when it comes again to chivalry, this very aspect of being noble, of being honorable, of being decent, of being modest, we find this in the land of Karbala, but we don't find it on the side of the forces of evil or on the side of the army of Yazid under the command of Umar ibn Sa'd. Matter of fact, we see this chivalry and this honor and this nobility on the side of truth and justice, which was the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, just to keep in mind, we can't really call the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam an army because there were so few in numbers. But every time one of the soldiers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam would come to the battlefield, they had this very honorable and noble and chivalrous manner that they had. You know, they would address the enemy, they would advise and give admonition to the enemy, and then, they would start the battle. And when they were martyred, they would request Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam to come and aid them.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about chivalry and Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We talked about how the companions of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and His Eminence, the Master of Martyrs, also showed chivalry both on the battlefield and off the battlefield. This sense of honor, this sense of nobility, this sense of chivalry was very apparent on the side and the followers and the family members of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now, we too in our life must be chivalrous, and we too must have this, you know, knightliness, if we don't have a better word to use at the moment. But this idea of being noble and honorable in our lives, this idea that we too, as a Muslim, living an Islamic lifestyle, we must carry ourselves with honor, with chivalry, and with nobility. As a Muslim, again, and as we live this Islamic lifestyle, we have to make sure to value ourselves and to give ourselves the proper value. And when we do give ourselves the proper value and we kind of attain this aspect and this characteristic of chivalry, then this will emanate in our actions, it will emanate in our speaking, and it will eventually even emanate in our thoughts, where we start to become in sync with our Islamic lifestyle and with our Islamic chivalry. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
But anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go at tea. Silence, fill the air.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
50 leaders from the EU and CELAC countries gathered in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday in what was the first summit of its kind for 8 years. CELAC consists of 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, is currently CELAC president. He says the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have brought misery to millions of citizens.
Rising prices, shortages of goods, and it's not just the war. It's the sanctions upon the war. The price of fuel, of food, borrowing of monies and so on.
Gonsalves certainly wasn't the only leader to tell EU decision makers that peace negotiations are needed to end the war in Ukraine.
La guerra de Ucrania.
The war in Ukraine must come to an end. The European Union and CELAC must, as an obligation, look for a way towards peace. We cannot live with this nightmare that any day now may see all hell break loose on all of us.
It was clearly an uncomfortable event for EU leaders as they wanted to focus on securing new energy supplies and critical raw materials in order to further isolate Russia and become less dependent on China. The visiting leaders refused to blindly follow the EU's anti-Russia rhetoric, analysts point out.
They're much more willing to call out what they see as the hypocrisy of great powers, you know, talking about other great powers and how they bully small states, given the histories of colonialism and American imperialism within Latin America.
The EU did manage to sign trade deals with Chile, Argentina and Uruguay on the sidelines of the summit. However, the relentless criticism of the 27-nation bloc support for the war continued.
O mundo gastou.
The world spent $2.24 trillion to fuel the war machine that only causes death, destruction and even more hunger. This summit is a way for us to say enough with that. Another world is possible.
Not only have calls here on EU leaders to facilitate peace negotiations fallen on deaf ears, but later this week EU foreign ministers will meet to agree on ways to apply more pressure on Russia while providing additional support to Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Money in exchange for stopping Tunisians from leaving the country. That's the core of the Memorandum of Understanding sealed in Tunis on Sunday by the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni under the supervision of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Actually, the memorandum is rather vague on financial figures. Some media have reported that the deal is worth 1 billion euros. Others say that the figures stipulated could change according to developments on the ground. What has emerged so far is that the EU intends to provide 105 million euros to Tunis to curb irregular migration. According to the European Coast Guard agency Frontex, there were more than 100,000 illegal border crossings through the central Mediterranean last year, a 50% rise compared to 2021, with Italy struggling to cope with this surge in arrivals.
We want real equality and do not want sympathy without respect. Today we need a collective agreement on inhuman migration and on the displacement processes behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices. According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbors. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Saied has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods such as fuel and bread. Saied has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
More than 500 Iranian enterprises and companies gathered to take part in an award ceremony that is expected to up their games and also allow them to gain a foothold in the OIC economy. Nearly 150 of them passed the quality control test to acquire four-star status, the highest defined by the Standard and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries, also referred to as SMIC.
This award, or better said, the four-star certificate, represents the highest standard of Iranian products, according to OIC member states. It will allow our companies to export their goods and services to OIC member states and also improve market conditions and competitiveness.
The standards bring the specification of the products. If you know what is the products, what ingredients, what the specification of the products, you can easily trade. And this brings also international recognition of the products, and free trade will bring the remove the barriers.
The companies that were awarded the certificate and acquired the four-star status couldn't agree more.
I believe that the true award is the trust that our customers have in our products. The fact that they believe our name stands for high-quality products, for me, is more valuable than any award or certificate.
The companies that are active in food industries definitely require international standards, and for OIC member states, the halal standard is of great importance. We tried very hard to reach this level and gain the four stars and the halal certificate.
The Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is the most important organization in compiling standards in the fields of food, health, and tourism management systems accepted by 57 member states of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. The Islamic Republic of Iran is one of the most active members of the Technical Committee of SMIC.
As an institute developing the necessary mechanisms in the OIC, the Standards and Metrology Institute of Islamic Countries is paving the way for member states to recognize each other's standard certificates. This will in turn help to boost trade. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration or harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Is GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is therefore all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD economic outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. The wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%. The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport, and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adherent to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi prime minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
On Thursday, tens of thousands of rail workers in Italy staged a day-long walkout over pay and safety at work, hampering public transportation services and tourists' access to their destinations. The strike action, called by the three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and WIL, caused cancellations and delays to national and regional trains at the peak of the country's booming high tourist season. Italy, like much of Europe, is suffering from high inflation and stagnant economic growth, and unions are protesting against low wages, especially in relation to the ongoing increase in the cost of living.
Today's action revolves around two issues. We demand an adjustment of the collective pay agreements for our sector and more hiring to ease pressure on employees and their unsustainable workloads. Furthermore, more investments on railway maintenance are needed. Last-minute negotiations with the Transport Ministry failed on Tuesday. The government showed up too late.
Also, air transport workers are set to down tools on Saturday despite Transport Minister Matteo Salvini's attempts to persuade unions to call off the strikes. This new industrial action, the latest in a long line of transport strikes, is widely expected to be more disruptive than most, which are generally only backed by one or two major unions. Commuters are once again facing delays and cancellations. They are saying they are at the end of their rope.
Disruptions keep affecting us. It's not just about tourists. Commuters are those who are bearing the brunt for the mismanagement of our public transport system. This way, they force people to resort to their cars.
Workers' wages in Italy are excessively low. I understand those who are staging the strike. As a result, commuters are left to face the music.
About 90% of rail transport sector workers joined the strike called by CGL, CISL and WIL unions. even high-speed lines that are usually guaranteed during Italy's frequent work stoppages were affected. Max Civili, Rome.
Omani Foreign Minister Badr al-Busaidi arrived in Iran on Monday. The Omani top diplomat was greeted by Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian. The Iranian top diplomat and his Omani counterpart held a meeting in the Institute for Political and International Studies of Iran's Foreign Ministry in the capital, Tehran. The duo, accompanied by other officials, held a meeting to discuss the latest bilateral, regional, and international events. Following their meeting, Amir Abdullahian and al-Busaidi held a joint press conference. The two top diplomats described their meeting as constructive and called for further cooperation between the two countries. The Omani foreign minister, for his part, hailed his meeting with Amir Abdullahian. He called for the development of economic, trade, and cultural ties between the two countries. He added that Iran and Oman see eye to eye on many issues. Amir Abdullahian hailed mutual ties as outstanding, strategic, and robust. He also appreciated Oman's role in facilitating regional talks and narrowing differences, as well as efforts to facilitate negotiations aimed at removal of sanctions on Iran. In addition, the Iranian foreign minister lambasted the recent statement by Russia and the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council regarding Iran's sovereignty over three islands south of the country, saying these islands are an inseparable and eternal part of Iran.
After we summoned the Russian ambassador yesterday, we received some explanations from Russian officials through diplomatic channels. The offered explanations are insufficient. We will never tolerate such interferences from Russia or any other sides regarding Iran's territorial integrity.
A recent joint statement by some Persian Gulf Arab states and Russia called for talks on the sovereignty over the three Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa and the Greater and Lesser Tunbs. Tehran has repeatedly rejected the UAE's claims over the islands, saying they have historically been part of Iran and will remain so.
Mr. Amir Abdullahian's remarks had a clear message, and that is no other country is allowed to mess with Iran's territorial integrity and national interests. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners from all around the world. Back to reality again. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. Today, I have the honor to be in this episode of Back to Reality. And with me, there are two dear guest speakers, Brother Dawood and Brother Mehdi. Assalamu alaikum, brothers.
Assalamu alaikum. I am Dawood, and I am very happy to be at your service.
Alaikum assalam.
Could you please introduce yourself briefly for me and the listeners?
Hello everyone, I'm Mehdi. I'm here in Qum for the last 6 years studying the seminary.
Thank you. And Brother Dawood?
Assalamu alaikum.
Salam.
I am Dawood and I have been teaching English for over 25 years and I've got MA in TEFL, teaching English as a foreign language.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to have you both in here. As you know, we're struggling with three major things in our life. Past, present, and future. Mm-hmm. There are many cliche quotes that you have to seize the moment, you have to enjoy life at the moment and things like that. But we all know that it is something a bit of impossible to believe that you can live in the present because the present is the future of the past and the past of the future, you know. So you cannot define time as something like line definition. It has more dimensions than that. And unfortunately, one of the problems that we are struggling with is living in the past, just struggling in the present and the future and sacrificing them to think about the past that we cannot even change.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to make it more personal here. Are you kind of person who live in the past?
Absolutely.
Oh my gosh.
Unfortunately, I feel like I am bothering myself sometimes,
yeah.
telling me that, yes, why didn't I do that? Or why didn't I say something better when it was the situation was due to say that sentence? This gives me a feeling of burden of that time. Why did I lose that opportunity for not saying that word to my friend or something else? Probably like I was experiencing something in the past and I am always blaming myself. Why didn't I experience it the other way around? And probably even if I was doing the other way around, I would constantly say to myself, why didn't I do the things in the first place that I have originally experienced?
You are perfect.
You know, we have the life. Most of us, I feel like most of us have two lives. The life that we live and the life that we didn't live, or we call it unlived life. I don't know if I am. It is an unlived life within us. And
your regrets.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. I start to regret. Between these two stands a feeling of regret.
Yeah. So,
do I live in the past? Yeah, I do.
Is it too much to hurt you?
No, no. Look, I've realized that, I've come to terms with the fact that my past has helped me tremendously. And how I live in the past is not really mentally. No, it's not, you know.
Yeah.
I do not mentally live in the past. Yeah, on and off, you're reminded of, you know, you see an image, you see a photo, for example, you see a photograph, you read something, you go to a place, you visit a place, and you're reminded of certain things that happened in the past. That's completely different. That's not called living in the past. But living in the past, in a sense, I constantly do live in the past. How? When I have an interaction, I have to make a decision in life. That's the moment I do go back. I live in the past, and I realize that, you know, I actually search my past. You know, you go back and you search your past, and you're like, wait, was I in a similar situation in the past? How had I performed it? What had I done? And what should I have done? You know? And what should I not have done, right? These are crucial moments where, you know, I do refer to my past. And I think I also should refer to my past in those stages. Yeah, otherwise, living in the past with regrets and stuff like that, not really. On and off, things happen that make you think about things that you could have done. But yeah, alhamdulillah, I've got a habit of switching to the present and future very quickly.
Yeah.
Whenever something happens, yeah, there's something that I do is I switch to the present and then the future. Right, that has happened. I've messed up, for example. Right, okay, now what?
It happens for everyone.
Yeah, everyone, yeah.
Natural.
So, yeah, that's exactly why try to do, and to a very strong extent, I am successful. I switch to the present and then I move to a future. What am I supposed to do right now, and where am I supposed to head it?
Yeah.
Because I've messed it up, you know.
Yeah,
so I need
to
fix it. Where do I go? This is something that I try to utilize
my
time
in.
You
have a nice point of view, in my opinion. So let's seize the moment and go for a short break. Then we're going to go for the future part of the episode. So we're here again, and we're talking about the amount that people would live in the past, in their past, you know. And I think there should be something like that in everybody's life. And if you are that kind of person that think your life is la vie en rose and you're living a beautiful life and you are seizing the moment, I think you are a bit out of the circle of thinking, you know. You have to be more aware that sometimes just spotlights of our past life are so crucial and are so effective for the future of our lives. And of course, there should be a balance between thinking about the past and the future and so on, but it matters. It's not like you tell me that, okay, past is in the past. Yes, past is in the past. You cannot change it, but you can change the future by the usage of the past life of yourself.
Yeah.
And another thing which I want to talk about is about history. You know, history, I think, is one of the indications that will tell us past is important. There are some people who think that history is all a bunch of lies.